This is the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show, Series 4, Episode 14. Hi, you're listening to the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show. You can find us at pitchvision.com. You can call us on
0208 816 7691.
And you can email us on
coach@pitchvision.com.
My name's David Hinchliffe, and this week I'm joined by Mark Garraway. Welcome along to the show, Garras. We've definitely got some summer in the air here because I managed to open a window this morning. So,
oh, awesome.
Yeah, without freezing.
Oh, well done, mate. Congratulations. Well, I have to say, the cold hit me a little bit when I got off the plane on Saturday night.
Yeah,
it was a bit. It was a little bit cheeky in the minus figures. It wasn't quite like that in Sardinia, but I've acclimatised and it's about 9 or 10 out there today. I mean, that's almost cricket weather, isn't it?
Yeah, well, of course, famously there was an England match against the West Indies. I think it was in Durham when it was 8 degrees.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
and that looked a bit chilly.
Well, England played out in Delhi recently, didn't they? At the beginning of the tour that they had out there,
and oh, that's right.
It was 4 degrees out there, and that was pretty grim. And I watched some highlights from the Aegeus Bowl the other day between Surrey and Hampshire, and they got snowed off twice on day one. So that looked pretty grim as well.
Well, of course, cricket hasn't always been played in the summer. There's when it was first being formalised as a sport, it was often played all year round, and there's many a record of games being played through December, New Year's Day matches, and I can't imagine they must have been hardy as stock back in the 17th century.
Yeah, I sure imagine they were, mate, because I wouldn't have fancied that too much. I don't know about you.
They didn't even bother with pads and the like. They just got on with it.
That's the way. You get a stinger on the inside thigh at -2. That would have been fairly cheeky, I reckon.
There was a bowler as well. I can't remember his name, but he's very famous for... this just shows how times have changed. I can't remember what it was, but he was a very talented bowler. But towards the end of his career, he had a terrible case of gout, which he couldn't shake off. So what he would do is, between overs, he would just go and sit in a bath chair and wait for his next over, and then come back and bowl his however many balls it was at the time, 4 balls or whatever, and then he'd go back and sit in his bath chair again.
And there are a few present day cricketers that would quite fancy that as a way of going through things and maybe extending their careers a little bit, and certainly extending the amount of overs that they could bowl in a day. But in many ways, I'm glad those days are gone and we've got a more athletic game. From a spectacle point of view, I'm not sure I'd have been up for that.
No, exactly. Different times, of course. But let's bring things up to date. We had some follow-up from last week where, of course, we were talking about switch hits and reverse sweeps and all the rest of it. And I thought it was quite interesting. It was Robin on Facebook. He posted a link on our Facebook page, which is over at Pitch Vision Academy, if you have a look there. And he was taking a bit more of a traditional view. So I wanted to just chat about that little bit of follow-up that Robin had, which was, he said, whatever happened to the art of building an innings? The switch hit and so on is an advanced shot that should only be taught to batsmen once he or she has mastered the core principle of batting. One only has to look at Steve Waugh, a fantastic batsman who acknowledged his limitations and built his game around a core selection of shots. Look to the likes of Ricky Ponting and Matthew Hayden, who dominated the game with averages of well over 50 in Test cricket, yet never played switch hits or deal scoops, etc. What's your thoughts on that, Garris?
Well, I mean, I agree with Robin, and I think we mentioned that last week, was that, you know, you want to build these shots on top of a foundation, which he's talking about here, the same foundation that the likes of Waugh, Ponting and Hayden had in their games. So I agree with him in that respect, and we went back to the philosophy of the coach, weren't we? Remember last week we were talking about the philosophy of the coach and how important it is for that coach to communicate his philosophy or her philosophy to parents and players, so everybody knows what's being expected. And then, but also having the flexibility to build these shots in as and when they're required with any individual player. And I think it's massive that the two can work together. And I'm sure that if Steve Waugh would have been brought up in this era rather than the sort of late 80s, early 90s, then we'd have seen a slightly different Steve Waugh. I don't think we'd ever have seen a massively expansive player, but we'd have seen somebody who would have had the ability to flip it up over fine leg as and when was required, because one of the things that Steve Waugh was very good at was strategy. And, you know, the game has moved on at a huge rate in recent years, but what I see now is good players being successful across all of the different formats. You look at somebody like Jai Wardner, and his record across all three is fantastic, but built on a foundation that Robin is talking about here. But actually, he's got the ability to flip it up over fine leg in the same way as other guys have do. It's just that he has to use it less readily because the rest of his all-round game allows him to score at an accelerated rate anyway.
Yeah, it's not one or the other, I don't think. It's, you know, it's easy to get caught up in this idea of, you know, let's just teach the basics and let's not get caught up with these exciting shots which have only just come into the game. But I don't think it's an either-or proposition at all.
I mean, most of the reasons why this has come into the game has been because of strategy. You know, and if normal boundary options are cut off by a good field set, then obviously you go to that flip. If you've got third man and fine leg up, then it's a relatively safe shot if you practice it sufficiently. So, you know, it's all based on strategy. And one of the things that Steve Waugh, who's mentioned in this, and many others were blooming good at was strategy. And and if the gaps are cut off somewhere else, then they would come up with another option. And that's why they ended up being the top of their game. So I actually think that David Warner is somebody who has got a pretty good core foundation to his game. He drives the ball down the ground while he plays a good pull shot and plays quite nicely off the back foot through cover. I think one of the reasons why he's been able to take his game from 2020 up to Test match cricket has been because he's got a good foundation to his game. And yes, he hits the ball really, really hard. But actually, you know, he doesn't do a massive amount of flipping and deal scoops. He actually just plays conventional cricket shots. And that's why I quite like him. And that's why I think he's a dangerous Test player, as well as being an excellent T20 player.
Yeah, and of course, you can, especially in club cricket, you can be a perfectly decent batsman without ever having to play a shot like that. There's no requirement to do it, but it's a nice thing to be able to have, especially if the higher up the levels you go, the more range of shots you'll want to try and develop over time. But yeah, if you're a type of batsman who plays in club cricket and you've got three shots which you're absolutely can rely on every Saturday afternoon or Sunday afternoon whenever you play, then carry on. You don't have to learn them, do you?
No, absolutely right. And I think that the rule changes, the regulation changes now around one day cricket is actually going to take us back a little bit in terms of playing conventional shots, because with one extra fielder in the inner ring and one less fielder on the boundary, those boundary options that have often caused people to go to dill scoops and flipping it up over fine leg aren't going to be so needed so readily and so often, because conventional shots probably over the top of the inner field, but generally conventional shots are going to get you your boundaries. So I'm interested to see how it all evolves over the next 2 to 3 years as people start to get used to the new ODI and T20 rules that are coming.
I think generally people will stop thinking so much about, you know, less anyway, thinking about the traditional way of, you know, if you get a half volley outside off stump, you automatically play a cover drive. And this is already happening. People are thinking in areas to score and knowing where what areas they can score in and think of it more of as a way of, you know, where you're hitting the ball rather than a shot to a particular ball, which is what the MCC coaching book might have said.
Yeah, and as I say, I think that the new rule changes are going to make a little bit of a shift from that, because obviously you've got to be playing on some very good surfaces to be able to hit a length ball from outside off stump over the top of square leg.
Yeah,
you know, and not everybody has the virtue to be playing on those on a regular basis. But having one less fielder out on the boundary is going to make a massive difference. And I predict a sort of reversion of of technique to start hitting more conventional, as we record it, in inverted commas, shots to get maximum runs. And, you know, let's be honest, the good guys, the likes of Warner and Gale, who are exceptional 2020 players and very dangerous test players, pretty much just put their bat through the line of a ball, don't they? They don't tend to get inside it too often and flip it. They just hit straight through the line of a ball. And that's going to reap them huge rewards with one less fielder out in the boundary.
Yeah, definitely. And no one ever puts a fielder directly behind the stumps at the bowler's end, do they? So if you know, if you hit the ball straight, then there's a fairly good chance it's going to go for four.
Yeah, correct.
Exactly. But then also on the flip side of that argument, that no one ever puts a fielder behind the wicketkeeper. So if you dill scoop it.
Oh, I've seen that, David. I have seen that.
Oh, they do it now, do they?
Yeah, well, I wouldn't say now, but a mate of mine, he used to be a happy hooker, and he had this brilliant skill to be able to have a hook and consistently get it over the top of the keeper's head, right. One bounce for four. So Northants decided to put a man about 10 yards in from the boundary directly behind the fielder. and then Paul Whittaker, his name was, had a hook, it hit even more of the toe end of the bat and went to the vacant third man area where they pulled that fielder from when it went for four. So that was all good. I enjoyed that. But yeah, so I've only seen it once, but I thought it was worth a mention.
And he claimed he placed it there afterwards, I expect. Oh,
mate, Paul Whittaker would claim every shot that he played that got a run was intentional. So, and it was very, very funny. And it was Scott Boswell who was bowling at the time, actually, and didn't see the funny side of it at the time, but does now.
Let's go into the yes-no round and finish off our little opening section. Three questions that myself and Gareth can only answer yes or no to, even if we want to say more about it. So I'll be reading the questions this week. Gareth, if you can give me your answers as soon as I've asked the questions. So, first question. All junior level coaches should understand strength and conditioning.
No.
Yes. There's a lack of good left arm fast bowling talent.
Yes.
Yes. Third question. Bowled after a leave, the worst way to get out.
Yes.
No. Right, so this is the main portion of the show, the exciting part where we get to talk about cricket coaching for a little while. And of course, we have a couple of questions that get sent in every week. And the best one of those questions wins a prize, which is an online coaching course, courtesy of Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. And the first question this week is from our regular correspondent. He sent in some questions in the past, and that's Cups. And Cups ask, I struggle to keep the seam pointing towards the first lip area when I bowl out swingers. Are there any drills to help fix this? Or do I just need to bowl?
It's a good question, Cups, and one that I come across every week when I'm working with young bowlers and more importantly, with young coaches or people that aren't elite fast bowling coaches. Now, elite fast bowling coach would tell you that the reason why the seam you're unable to get it to point to first slip is often not because of the way you're holding it or your wrist position at release, but actually something that's happened beforehand, because that's pretty much our wrists are the most difficult thing to control, because they move around as a consequence of what's happened beneath them in the bowling action. So what I would always say is, if you can get a bit of footage of yourself, take yourself back to the point where things start to misalign or move away or whatever the case may be, which then causes your wrist not to get behind the ball in the way that the seam can go down to first slip. So I know a lot of coaches years ago would talk about keeping your fingers behind the ball and flicking the ball and everything, but that's all very well and good. But if your body's leaning over to extra cover when you bowl into a right-hander, then you're not going to be getting your wrist in that perfect position to get behind it. So it's the action that causes your wrist to not be in the right place to get that seam going in the right direction, mate, rather than the wrist itself. So without looking at video, it's impossible to tell what part of the action and what happened, where you have to take it back to pick it up and do something about it. But I very, very rarely coach the wrist. The wrist position, because it's something else that's gone on in the action. And what you tend to find is, if you get the alignments right and you get the forces going in the right place, then the wrist will go in the right position, and then that seam position that you're talking about will go down in the direction that you want.
Now, what would you say some important things to look out for cups would be? Obviously, we don't know what's going wrong with cups, but when you see a bowler doing that, where does your eye draw to first? Is it the front? What happens with the front arm? What happens with the front foot landing? What kind of a checklist do you go through as a coach?
It normally happens before that, to be brutally honest. And again, those sort of things are the consequence of what's generally gone beyond. And I always take it back to the step before you jump in the air is often the thing that throws you off. So most people will run in, and then because they want to bowl straight, they'll turn just before their last step, their bound strike. So if you're a right arm bowler, just before your left foot hits the ground for the last time before you jump, what generally happens is the body starts to turn in towards the stumps. And we're built to compensate. So as we jump in and land on our back leg bends, and then we go, hang on a minute, all of our energy is going down the fine leg. And then the body then opens up and we get that horrible bowing in the back as our front foot lands and we go to ball release. And of course, from that position, it's nigh on impossible to get your fingers behind the ball and to line that seam up to first slip. So always have a look at your bound step. See how that's aligned. See how your bound is aligned. Okay. And if you're ducking in, then work off about two paces to get your alignment in your bound absolutely spot on. And if you can do that, you'll find that your body position at ball release will be that much better. And if you're doing that, then your fingers are going to be behind the ball and your wrist is going to be promoting a perfect seam position going towards first slip for that away swing. So always take it back to root cause would be to try and sum that up. And the only way you can really do that is by getting video out, whether it be on your mobile phone or on any of the digital cameras that I wrote about the other week.
Yeah, that's interesting in my experience as well. I mean, I've been coaching with some talented under-11s over the last few months. And one of the things that I've noticed when they're bowling is that they're all very keen to have a super-duper run-up. And they don't really think very much about the action itself. Last week, I did a session where we had a little game at the end of it. And I made them bowl from one pace when they were bowling. And they were all very surprised. No run-up. Why can't I run-up? I said, well, you know, it's all about the action, not so much about the run-up. The run-up is part of it, but it's a smaller part of it than everything else. So when you're looking at correcting these kind of problems, one of the first things to do really is to take the run-up away, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And then you can isolate the various bits of the action. But that bound is so crucial. So always take it back to that bound and see what's happening as you're going into that bound, because that has a knock-on effect to everything else that happens in the bowling action. And as I say, we're made to compensate. So if we compensate because something's wrong, and if we take the thing that's wrong out of it, then we won't need to compensate, and you've got a much better chance of getting that release position right.
Now, in your experience, how hard is it to correct something like that? Because it does become habit quite quickly, doesn't it, with a bowling action?
Yeah, it takes a lot of patience and a lot of work to get that absolutely spot on. But just because Cups has asked a question tells me that he wants to improve, and I'm sure that if he was actually video himself and then have a look at his bound and the alignment of his bound, then he would find that that would be some good work. And if he put a couple of hundred repetitions in there, I'm sure that he'd probably find a massive difference.
Okay, let's move on to the next question. This one is from Mark. He sounds like he's a coach, and he sounds like he's a coach who's just about to start a cricket season, because his question is, when designing a program for junior cricketers in season, how do you structure sessions?
Well, I think that's a very individual thing, mate, to be honest with you, because my idea of structuring things would be very much different to other coaches' idea of structuring things. And again, we talked about coaches' philosophy last week, and if the philosophy of the coach is to create an environment where people can make decisions, can be allowed to make mistakes and can create their own ways of going about things, then, you know, structure isn't massively important within that. I think every session needs a start, a beginning, you know, a middle and an end in terms of what you want to get out of it, and almost a picture of where you want it to go. But some coaches will be very definitive in the way that they will go about their coaching structure within that session, having things down to, you know, every minute we're going to be doing this, next minute we're going to be doing that. Other guys will come in and say today we're going to have a net and I want us to focus on running between the wickets. That would be my preference. The second one would be to have a theme rather than an absolute structure to it. And say, right, in this session, I want us to get this done, that done, and maybe some of that. And let's see where we go. And a friend of mine, I was with a couple of guys last week who have huge amounts of military and active military experience. And they were telling me that, you know, a plan in terms of warfare only lasts up to the first contact with the opposition. And I think that any planning has to be a little bit like that. You have the idea of what you want to do, but if one of your players comes out with something slightly better, I think it would be a silly coach who would then say, no, we're going to stick to my plan because that's the way that we're going to do it. You have to have some flexibility within that. So, as I say, I have two or three things at the beginning of every practice session that I would like to cover, but I'm not a slave to that. But that's me, and I've worked with coaches that need to have more structure, and I've worked with coaches that need to have less structure, and they've all been good coaches. So, if you're a guy, by the sound of things, with words like design and structure in your session, if you're a guy that likes to have lots of checkpoints in your session to see where you are at any given point, then stick to that because that's you. But don't be a slave to it. And equally, if you're asking that question from a point of, I wish I could design and I wish I could structure sessions, then I would say, well, keep doing what you're doing. Just make sure you've got an endpoint to it. So, you know, it's each one to their own, in my view, mate. I mean, you and me, for example, we'd be very different in the way that we would structure a session.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it does. I think what you're saying there is a lot of it depends on the experience of the coach as well. I think if you're an inexperienced coach, then you don't want to too much be relying on your instinct of what happens if you just stick with having a theme and then get stuck in and then think to yourself, oh, I wish I could remember that fielding drill that I looked at 2 weeks ago. You're going to be struggling a little bit without some kind of a structure. But I think the more experience you get, the better you get at just being able to think of things on the fly and adapt and do things as you go. I mean, I do plan out my sessions before I do them, but I plan them out on one of these very small index cards, deliberately so, because I can get a little bit too detailed into things and end up being inflexible. So I just write down a couple of things that I want to get done so I don't forget what they are. Then I pop that in my pocket and then try and work out a few timings on things to make sure that, for example, everyone gets a bat if we're having a game at the end or something like that. But yeah, you've got to have the flexibility to say, okay, well, you know, things aren't quite going the way that I wanted to be going, so let's do some more on this, or they seem to have this down pat, let's move on to something else.
And when you write the stuff on those cards, David, do you ever sort of review and reflect on how you've gone against those three or four things that you've got written on the cards?
I always keep the cards in a little folder to have a look at what I did in previous weeks.
Yeah.
I would say that I don't really miss out on doing anything. Like I'll always get to say that if I've written down three things on that card, I'll always get those three things in.
Yeah. Okay.
So I don't have much of a review process apart from keeping the cards in a folder and having a little look to see what we've done. I also like to keep track of what they've done, some kind of scoring system for a lot of things that we do, which I know you're a fan of as well, to be able to track performance. And I keep all those as well in that little folder, and then we can track back and go, okay, well, 3 weeks ago, you scored 5 runs in your 2 overs. This week you scored 10. So well done, you're getting better.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's really good, mate. And you know, does that change? Does your process change? Not so much the monitoring, but your planning process change if you're leading a group of coaches as opposed to working on your own?
The only time that I've done that in recent times is with the under-11s at rep level. and it's just me and one other guy. So we don't really have much, you know, we have a good rapport. So there isn't much that changes.
Yeah, I mean, I had an interesting time last week in that I was working with Dean Headley and Paul Nixon.
Yeah.
And I had to adapt my style a little bit in terms of my planning. Right. So whereas if I'm working at school on my own, and obviously as long as I've got it in my head and, you know, it's relatively organised, then I'm quite happy to go with it.
Yeah.
But last week, because we had quite a big area that we were doing our cricket on, and we had three groups, I needed to have a little bit more structure behind it. And if I was to review on last week again, I'd probably have even more structure if we were to work again next week. So everybody knew where they were going. So again, reviewing the question that came in from Mark, you know, it actually depends on whether you've got a group of coaches, whether you've got a group of parents that might be helping you out, or whether you're on your own. And, you know, you might need to structure things a bit more if you're managing a group of coaches rather than just being the sole coach.
And then I think planning also becomes more important the further back you go. If you're looking a whole season, then you probably want to have a little bit more detail. I would say you want to have a little bit more detail. I mean, you don't need to have a complete, you know, 20-page document on what you're going to be doing, but I think you need to have a plan and some goals and some ideas of where you want to be at the end of the season.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that we're doing at the moment, actually, to that whole season idea that you just come up with has just triggered something in my mind, is that part of the planning that I do is to make sure that we look after our fast bowlers a bit, because for example, in the next 2 weeks, we've got a huge number of games, and if we're to flog our three main bowlers in that period, then there's a good chance that they're going to get injured. So in terms of structuring the question, designing a program for junior cricketers this season, with my fast bowlers, is actually quite a structured program, because it has to be in order to make sure that they remain healthy for the remainder of the season, or giving them the best chance of remaining healthy within the for the rest of the season. So the more I look at this question, the more that there's a bit of variety comes in, you know, whether you're working with other coaches, whether you're working on your own, whether you're working with fast bowlers over a season, you might need to factor that into your planning. But generally, I leave it fairly spontaneous outside of that.
Yeah, as with all questions, it depends, and you have to structure things around your particular requirements and your personality. So hopefully we managed to answer that question. It's one of those questions where the answer is so can vary so much, it's hard to answer any specific detail. But hopefully, Mark, you've got some things to work on, some things to think about, and come up with some plans, whether those are very detailed plans or just a vague idea of where you want to be.
Yeah, and that's very much down to you, Mark, as a bloke, and you know yourself much better than anybody else. So keep it authentic. Learn where you have to add a little bit of structure or take away a bit of structure, depending on the people that you're working with, and I'm sure you'll be fine.
It's time for the soapbox, and it's back-to-back 60-second sessions for Mark Garraway. He can talk about anything he likes, but he can't go over a minute. Garraz, over to you.
Well, I'm going to talk about playing cricket in the cold, because we're going on cricket tour up to Shrewsbury today, and we've got three games in 3 days, and I think we're probably going to get a maximum temperature of about 7 or 8 degrees. So it's all about preparation, and you know, there'll be a lot of cricketers in England. I know that other cricketers around the world might not experience this so much, but I'm going to give you a piece of our lives. So it's all about prep, and base layers are part of that preparation. So all of our guys have been asked to go off and get some base layers ready for this 3-day trip, and probably a little bit more of a summer, because we won't get warm just yet. Hand warmers as well, they're fantastic things. Stuff that's got a little bit of dynamite in there, I think, and you give it a shake and it retains some heat, and you get about 3 hours worth of warmth that you can put in your pockets. Put those in your pockets, get your hands in your pockets, and you get that extra bit of heat in there. And also woolly hats, and I've been watching a bit of county cricket on the internet for warm-up games, and everybody wearing woolly hats and looking quite a sight out there. Cups of tea are also a good idea as well. So we've got the water bottles ready to get filled with cups of tea. And my aim this week is not just to get some wins up at from Shrewsbury Festival, but to make sure that everybody doesn't grumble too much on the pitch because they're warm enough. So preparation is the key.
Well, I don't often chip in with anything after the soapbox, but I have to say I completely agree with you about those Under Armour style shirts. I've got one myself, and it's kept me kept me from getting frostbite on many occasions, I'm sure. So good advice, Gareth. So that's the end of the show for this week. We do have a couple of other things to sort out, the first of which being the winner of this week's online coaching course from Pitch Vision Academy over at pitchvision.com, of course. And we had two questions this week. Cups was asking about seam position, and Mark was asking about junior cricketers' programme design. Which one did you prefer, Gareth?
Well, I thought, I mean, I always say this, but these were two really good questions because I actually looked at them and I thought Cups is going to win this hands down because we'll have a lot more to talk about. But actually, once we started to prompt each other with our own experiences, because we are different in the way that we plan, and also start to think more broadly about sessions versus season plans, we actually got in some pretty big stuff there. So I'm going to go with Mark's question this week around designing a programme for junior cricketers.
Yes, well, congratulations, Mark. That's excellent news for you, and we've got some good program design courses available. So you can head over to pitchvision.com, take a look at those, pick the one you like best. Now, Gareth, if someone was thinking to themselves, well, hang on a minute, I fancy getting something for free, I fancy getting my question answered, how would they send in their question to the show?
Well, they could give us a call on 0208 816 7691, or they could drop us a line at coach@pitchvision.com.
Yes, indeed. You can also post questions to Facebook. We often get our questions from Facebook. If you head over to facebook.com/pitchvisionacademy, there's videos posted every day there as well, and lots of comments and exciting stuff going on. It's quite a nice little community of coaches and players talking about technique and asking questions and answering questions. You can also find us on Twitter at PV Cricket Coach. And you can subscribe to the show if you like it and you want to listen every week. Head over to iTunes and do a search for Pitch Vision Academy. You'll find us in there. And if you don't want to use iTunes, then you can head over to pitchvision.com/academy. Click on the podcast and you can follow the instructions for getting the RSS feed. So that's all for this week. So until next time, we'll see you next week. Cheers, Gareth.
Cheers, coach. Take care, mate.